Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is really driving up the price of gas at a time when OPEC is producing more oil than global demand and gasoline demand in the United States is the lowest it's been for decades. So much so that oil companies are exporting record amounts of refined products. The former head of the Division of Markets and Trading at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Michael Greenberger, joins us to look into how much Wall Street speculators are driving up the price at the pump. Then author and journalist A.L. Press joins us. He is the author of a new book, Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. We'll examine the psychology of resistance and the courage of those who choose principle over loyalty, as well as the fate of whistleblowers who we all admire, but more often than not, do not emulate. Then finally, Deanne Lunan, an attorney and director of the National Consumer Law Center's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project, joins us. We will discuss the student loan debt bomb waiting to explode, with student loan debt in the United States now totaling more than $1 trillion, more than all of the outstanding credit card debt in the country. Joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Hi, Ian. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And what explains the precipitous rise in gasoline, given what I was just mentioning there in the opening, that there's a record amount of fuel on the global market? OPEC's been producing more oil than global demand. Gasoline demand in the United States is at the lowest it's been for decades, so much so that U.S. oil companies and oil refineries are exporting record amounts of refined products, and yet retail prices are up 36 cents a gallon in the last 2 months, and futures prices have risen even higher, 82 cents over the same period of time.
Well, Ian, as we've talked about this before, the futures price is probably the most critical price rather than the actual spot price for gasoline, because what the future price tells you is whatever we're seeing now, the price of gasoline is going to go much higher. The futures price is a price discovery mechanism. And as we've discussed before, I think you and I had our first discussion about this when oil hit a world record high of $147.17 in mid-July 2008. And gasoline prices were well over an average of $4 around the country. People agreed then, all economists who've studied this, or I should say the great majority of economists who studied this, have agreed. The United States Congress agreed when it passed Dodd-Frank. We just found out from WikiLeaks that the King of Saudi Arabia agrees about this. And on April 21st, 2011, President Obama endorse this view that it has nothing to do with supply-demand and everything to do with speculators driving the price up in the futures market by buying 33 times the amount of the world supply of oil in aid of bets on the price direction of oil. And for every penny it goes up, this is pocketed by big Wall Street speculators, led by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, but a lot of, quote, traders, close quote, on Wall Street, who are playing games with this market. And on April 21st, the last time we had one of these shocking rises, President Obama explained to the American people, this is not a supply-demand problem, this is a speculation problem by Wall Street traders. The very sad fact is, at that time, he asked the Attorney General of the United States to head a task force of every agency in the federal government that touches the price of gas to go after the manipulators and speculators. I would like to be corrected about this, but my intelligence is that that task force met once The Attorney General was not present. Everybody was told at the end of the meeting, let's keep in touch. And there has been no concerted effort by the Obama administration to fight this problem, which is really very sad for the president, because on all other fronts, his policies, his stimulus policies, have seemed to, at a very slow pace, but nevertheless a pace, to bring the economy back in a way that's been very helpful to him politically. And yet here's something that he identified almost a year ago, and his administration has completely let him down. And as you know, the Republicans are blaming the president for this problem. They're not talking about Wall Street speculators. What they're saying is we should be digging on the outer shore, create more environmental hazards like we had in the Gulf with the BP oil spill, go into precious and environmental reserves, that's how we'll get out of this. But as the Saudis and OPEC are saying, you can produce more oil till the cows come home, and it has no effect on the price. Production will go up, and contrary to all economic thinking, the price is going to go up, because production has nothing to do with the price. What it has to do is speculators buying 33 times the amount of oil that's available through paper bets that they place on futures and derivatives exchanges. And that's why we're having this problem.
So Michael Greenberger, again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, you would think the president, he has a dog in this fight, his re-election. And if only a week ago, John Boehner had a meeting with the Republican caucus and said that they should Republicans should take advantage of the anger over the price at the pump. So it's pretty clear to me that he has a real stake in it. So what's happening though with the oversight group that you used to be with, the Commodities Future Trading Commission? Their job is to regulate this market.
Yes, and this is another very sad story. Commodities Commission, like all independent agencies, is made up of three Democrats. When you have a Democratic president and two Republicans, unfortunately, as the agency was trying to do something about this on an administrative level, the three Democrats, one of them was an appointee by President Bush, and he was very instrumental in weakening proposed regulation that was supposed to come out of the Dodd-Frank bill. Dodd-Frank, which is the financial regulatory reform bill passed in July of 2010, addressed this issue and said, by God, CFTC, limit the speculation in these markets. They came out with a rule on a 3-2 vote, three Democrats, two Republicans, but because of this wavering Democrat, who, by the way, has since retired and gone into a lobbying firm, they produced a rule that was quite weak. And even though it was weak, the banks immediately went into court, and as we speak, they are trying to enjoin what little regulation we have to keep speculators out of these markets. So it's a very sad situation. We haven't been able to line our ducks up. But both the CFTC, the FTC, the Justice Department can go after these speculators on criminal indictments showing that there is an intent to adversely affect the price for no real economic interest other than lining the pockets of wealthy bankers. And that's what the president decided he wanted to do last April 21st, 2011. And I'm pretty confident that he's probably, in the last day or two, gotten on the phone and said to his attorney general, hey, whatever happened to that interagency task force you assembled? The problem is I think people who follow criminal fraud that's happened in this place, unfortunately, our Justice Department has really been asleep at the switch, not only on this, But as you know, there's been very little prosecution of the massive fraud that took place that led to the financial mortgage fraud meltdown in 2008-2009.
So Michael Greenberger, again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. If Commissioner Dunn, who was the swing vote, who was ostensibly a Democrat but sided with the Republicans, and the Republicans are clearly on the side of the speculators and not on the side of the consumers, the other two Democrats on the commission were on the side of the consumers. Doesn't the president have the ability to replace Commissioner Dunn?
Well, he already has, in fact, replaced Commissioner Dunn. Commissioner Dunn's term expired. It was really rather a miracle that they were able, you know, almost no one the president nominates gets confirmed.
So how did he get this guy on, and who is he, and what's his name?
Mr. Wetjen, W-E-T-J-E-N. Right. He was an aide to Senator Senator Byrd, the majority leader, and he has come on, and I am told he is going to be a person. He's new to this issue and issues of this sort, but he is much more reasonable than the commissioner who was obviously vying for a lobbying spot while he was still sitting in his commissioner chair. The trouble is the vote was done back at a time when Mr. Wetjen wasn't available. The rule is now out. It's being challenged in district court in D.C. It's very hard now to go back and to fix this. I think if I were the president of the United States and this were the fly in my ointment, which it really is right now, I would be getting on the phone to the Justice Department and taking another avenue, a criminal avenue, and telling the Attorney General to get that task force back together and start bringing investigations. Basically, my experience in this field is it's sort of like turning on lights with cockroaches. If you turn on the light of even an investigation in these markets, a serious investigation, even before indictments are issued, the speculators run like crazy. And what you will see, if an investigation is announced, the price of gasoline will go down. So I think the real vehicle here is for President Obama, who's been fighting the economic meltdown on so many fronts and beginning to see traces of real success, except for this problem that could break the back of the recovery. He should be on the phone with his attorney general, the chair of the FTC, the chair of the CFTC, the chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and tell them, get back to work and let's get investigations going. You have the authority to do this. You have the law that enables you to do this. And let's start getting to the problem that the president identified on April 21st, 2011, and Congress identified when it passed Dodd-Frank and instructed the executive branch to stop this problem in July of 2010.
So, Michael Greenberger, if there's nothing that can be done at the commission, even though there may well be a majority there that are advocates for the consumer as opposed to shills for the speculators, the LA Times, for example, has got an editorial today called "What to Do About $4 Gas." It takes the position that there are conspiracies on the right and the left and debunks the right-wing conspiracies about drill, baby, drill. But it also says the left has its own political talking points. Some on the fringes even believe rising prices are part of a right-wing conspiracy to slow the economic recovery and thus hurt Obama's re-election chances. Well, put me on the fringes, LA Times, because it seems to me there is an obvious connection here, because regardless of what we're talking about, which is what's really driving the price up, which is the speculation on Wall Street, just the 30 cents a gallon fear premium due to Iran is pretty clear. That's what oil traders are telling us. And I recall when the National Defense Authorization Act was before the president, which was, of course, pushed by the Republicans, particularly John McCain and Lindsey Graham. He said, I would veto this because it's going to cause a rise in the price of gas, which it's done. So it's not conspiratorial to suggest that Maybe they have other reasons, but the effects on what the Republicans are doing is driving up the price of gas in an election year.
Well, I think the Republicans, by continuously saying it's a supply-demand problem when it isn't, and we should, you know, dig in precious natural resources and expose ourselves to calamitous oil spills, that they're off in the wrong direction. I will tell you, Ian, if the Justice Department, with the aid of the CFTC, the SEC, the FTC, FERC, etc., announced even that they were studying an investigation on this, you would see the price drop 30 cents. In 1973, when OPEC completely cut off oil to Western countries at a time when Western countries were more dependent on OPEC, you only saw about one-third of the volatility in the price that we're seeing today. Whatever's happening in Iran, I mean, last spring it was Libya. Libyan problem, which was 2% of the oil production, which the Saudis said they would make up. That was the excuse then. Now it's Iran. As you say, supply-demand is an equipoise. Yes, maybe there should be on the fringes price rises because of instability. But in 1973, when we lost our supply completely, we didn't have this kind of price rise and this volatility. If there were investigations launched, and my own view is it's like shooting fish in a barrel to bring these investigations, you will see the price of oil drop rather dramatically. And every time the federal government lifts its finger, in fact, when the president said back in April that it was speculators, the price of gasoline started to drop when this interagency task force was assembled. The problem is they didn't do anything. And now, if the president doesn't get on top of this issue, it is maybe now we'll say the fly in the ointment, but it could break the back of the fragile recovery that he is benefiting from right now. And he must turn the entire resources of the executive branch onto this problem. We have seen time and time again, going back to when oil reached a world record high in July of 2008, investigations were announced. It went from $147 in July of 2008 to $33 by December of 2008. The investigations didn't go anywhere, and the price started going back up again. If the federal government will assume a law enforcement posture with this problem, or for that matter, you could have, you know, even your very prominent attorney general in California, if she were to turn her attention to this problem and announce investigations, it's like turning a light on with cockroaches. The speculators will run for cover. They'll unwind their contracts. They'll worry about spending time in jail away from their houses in the Hamptons, and we'll get lower prices. It's as simple as that.
Well, my understanding, Michael Greenberger, just in closing, is that oil traders are saying, or analysts of the oil market are saying, that we're already, with the speculation that's in the pipeline now, 82 cents compared to 36 cents in the rise. In other words, it's, you know, it's like the deer and the python.
No, that's not right. Look, when oil was in July 15th, 16th, and 17th, when oil was at a record high, $147. We still haven't reached that level yet in this spike.
Right, but isn't it coming based upon the trajectory?
No, it could be stopped. And the point I'm trying to make: when oil was at $147, Goldman and Morgan Stanley were telling us it would be at $200 by December 2008. When investigations got launched, both by Congress and the executive branch, over that summer, the price went not to $200. But the $33.
Just in closing, though, why is it that we're having this discussion, and I haven't heard this discussion anywhere else? What is wrong with our press? Every night you see on the local TV news about the price at the pump. What is wrong with the press? Why can't they focus in on this 900-pound gorilla sitting in the living room?
Well, let me say this. You know, you, of course, are way ahead of the curve on this, as you usually are. But I am detecting now, I'm getting calls from a lot of media, and this will be put back on the front burner. It should have happened weeks ago, but it will be, you'll start hearing about speculation very soon. And if the president is smart, and he's shown a lot of smarts in dealing with the economy, at least creating a fragile recovery that's put him in a very strong position politically, I believe and I hope within a month or so you will start seeing, first of all, this will be very widely talked about, as it was in 2008. 60 Minutes, for example, had a very powerful segment on this back in that time period. The press will be back on this, and it's just, unfortunately, Ian, you're ahead of the curve right now, but I think you're going to see others will catch up with you.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Greenberger.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of Beautiful Souls. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is A.L. Press, an author and journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, and The Nation, among others. He was a 2011 Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation and the recipient of the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. He's the author of Absolute Convictions, and his latest book just out is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, A.L. Press.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And you start the book out describing one of the infinite number of horrors that took place during the Holocaust in Poland in 1942, where the Germans were just herding Jewish women and children into the woods and shooting them from dawn to dusk, and the soldiers were exhausted and drenched in blood, and the officer gave some of the soldiers the option of not having to participate in this extermination of human beings. And it sort of made me think, my God, you know, here we are today with a similar situation happening in Syria, in effect, where soldiers are being, arguably worse, soldiers are being asked to murder their fellow Syrians, and if they don't do it, they get a bullet in the head.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a fair point. And I think that I started the book. The book is, as you mentioned, about individuals who break ranks, whether that be soldiers caught in the midst of a war or at a massacre, or in the case of the final character in the book, a financial industry worker who also engages in undertakes an act of courage to speak out about wrongdoing and fraud. That opening story is the book opens on that, because when we think of those massacres that took place in places like Poland in 1942, we tend to think that there was no choice involved, these were low-ranking soldiers, they were in a totalitarian system, and so when they were told to shoot innocent people, they had to do it, and if anyone dared to not do it, they would be shot. What's remarkable about that story, and I'm not the first to tell it, it's from a remarkable book called Ordinary Men, but what's remarkable about the story is that before the massacre, the commander, as you mentioned, told the soldiers that anyone, any of the older men who did not want to participate, could put their guns down. And some of them did do this, but not enough, of course, to stop the massacre from happening. But I froze that moment early in the book and set it up because I think that we need to reclaim the reality that even in situations of seemingly total conformity like that one, there are always some people who don't go along. And we need to know the stories of these people, not only because they remind us that, you know, there's more than one path, but also because we really can't judge, much less hold accountable, the conformists who did something we think is wrong. We can't really judge them and answer the claim that they were just doing what anyone in their shoes would have, unless we know the stories of those who found the courage to resist and unless we tell those stories.
Just in terms of, though, of our collective conscience as a country, we're very much on trial every day, if you will, in a geopolitical sense. For example, the Iraq War, of course, was sold to us on moral grounds that this terrible man had to be, Saddam Hussein had to be gotten rid of. And a lot of that was based on lies, which I think has done huge damage. And of course, the torture that ensued with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib has done untold damage to the reputation of this country, because dictators now can say, well, you know, we're free to torture our people because the Americans do it. But we've gone through something of a national debate over intervening in Libya, which the U.S. managed to sort of outsource to NATO. And now we have a situation where we're facing Syria, and people are being slaughtered by a government that is just appallingly brutal and basically trying to kill their people into submission while we stand on the sidelines. Now, the reason that I think, and of course you can go back to Milosevic, where Europe was revisiting the crimes of the Nazis. The crimes of the Nazis are the thing that inform us so much about the idea that there is a moral imperative to intervene and stop genocide. So how does your story relate to that broader picture? Because, as I say, both as individuals, we have to face these moral challenges, and as a country, we also have to face it.
Yeah. That's a complicated question. You know, the book, there's certainly an element to the book where I'm raising questions about society, and one of the most crucial questions that the book really ends on when I tell the story of this whistleblower is we often think that that bad social blunders like the Iraq War or like the financial crisis of 2008, that these terrible blunders, which leave so much damage, happened because too few people who saw what was happening spoke out and said something and raised their voices and warned. That is true, largely speaking, but I think it's too easy and not wholly accurate. I think there's a deeper problem, which is that as a society, we do not listen to the people who do speak out. And it's quite striking if you go back and look at the financial companies that were engaging in all kinds of blatant wrongdoing, Countrywide, for example. Well, there was actually a whistleblower in Countrywide trying to draw attention to what was happening. She was recently profiled on 60 Minutes.
Right, and the Justice Department apparently still hasn't talked to her.
That's right. That's right. So it's a question of listening and the institutions that ought to be there to listen and don't. In the case of the story that I told, Stanford, well, we all read and heard about this Ponzi scheme after the financial crash.
You know, after Enron, yeah.
2008.
And after Enron, right.
But bear in mind, the character I wrote about wrote a letter to the SEC about what was happening at Stanford and saying in bold capital letters, this may be a massive Ponzi scheme in 2003.
This is Layla Wilder.
Wilder, yes.
Right.
And no one listened. And now you can say, well, okay, there are a lot of letters that come across the desk of folks working at the SEC. The same letter, by the way, was sent to various newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and others. You can say, well, okay, but these places are flooded with material every day, and a lot of things get overlooked. Well, Layla Wilder didn't just send this letter. She actually spoke on the phone with someone in the SEC in Texas. She made a personal appeal before an arbitration board. It's not as though people had every reason to know and understand that this was actually an experienced broker inside the company saying these things, that she had been fired for no reason other than asking questions, and that she was very worried that a broader scandal was going on. Well, as I say, it was 5 years afterwards that Layla Wilder got a call one day from someone at the SEC who said, Ms. Wilder, we'd like to talk to you about a former employer of yours. And she said, let me guess, Stanford. And, you know, of course, instead of laughing, this made her want to tear her hair out, because it's the societal responsibility that I think we fail to listen to these voices. And indeed, if you look at the United States, the term whistleblowing was coined here. Studies show there are more whistleblowers here than in any other country. And yet the whistleblowers don't have much of an effect. And why don't they have much of an effect? I think it can be traced directly and clearly to the fact that we're too distracted and we don't listen, and the institutions that ought to be paying attention to the dissenting voices don't. And ironically, we all have an interest in that, but we don't do it enough.
It's pretty amazing to me, and I'm sure it is even more so to you, A.L. Press, that given your previous book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict that Divided America, where you tell the story of what happened to your father, Dr. Shalom Press, who, after his colleague Barnett Slepian, a gynecologist, was murdered by an assassin from Operation Rescue, they turned their targets to your father. And you had Operation Rescue people in protesting your home and your father's office, picketing his waiting room, and you growing up with all of this right in your face. And you've written about it, of course, and tried to understand what motivated the people to both kill a doctor and protest abortion. I mean, it seems to be front and center now in our political debate. I mean, maybe it didn't go away, but I find it extraordinary. What's your sense? I know I'm changing the subject a little bit.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I would say two things about that. I'm glad you brought those events up, because they do illustrate one thing that I touch on in the book, and it's important. We've talked a lot here about acts of conscience performed for admirable ends. But let's remember that the original notion of the voice of conscience was that this was the voice of God, that an individual was hearing the voice of God and telling them to do something that they believed they had to do. As various people who write about this, philosophers and so forth, have noted, and I quote Susan Sontag noting this, you know, that voice doesn't always tell you to do something admirable. And conscience alone can take various directions. So in the example of Operation Rescue, it brought people to blockade clinics to prevent women from reaching clinics, or in even more extreme cases, it led some zealots to decide that they had to pick up a gun and start shooting people. So conscience alone is not automatically something that one applauds, nor is resistance alone. What really matters is the moral content of that resistance. Having said all of that, we certainly have not ended the debate about women's choice and reproductive rights. And indeed, I'm quite astonished that back when I was writing that book, the issue was abortion, today, the issue is contraception and access to contraception. And to some extent, that just shows you that that the forces opposing women's rights are gaining and have been gaining.
Well, just to, in closing, I'm quoting your father, a gynecologist, who was saying, who said at the time, "I respect people who are opposed to abortion. It's their view, their right, but it's unacceptable to me the way they're trying to impose it on other people." And that seems to be the heart of what's happening now. It's not this debate over contraception and the stand that's being taken in this so-called phony war on religion that's being ginned up at the moment. That's inherent in it.
Right. And it's the imposition on others that I think ultimately, having said what I said, and I believe it, that the debate in Washington, if you watch the Republican political debates, you would think that the country's all ready to ban the sale of the pill.
Again. Sure. Well, just as your father was charged with infanticide last night, Newt Gingrich charged President Obama with infanticide.
Yes, that's true. I watched the debate and noted the ugly use of the, an ugly and sloppy use of that term. But I will say this. I would not guess that position of rolling back access to contraception is going to get a Republican presidential candidate very far, including with Catholic voters, by the way. I mean, you've seen the polls, but the overwhelming majority of voters, women, Catholics, Jews, Christians, believe what, you know, has become a clear reality that, that this is that young people who are engaging in sexual activity ought to have access to contraception, and that to pretend that we can just teach abstinence and solve the problem is I think a very dangerous and reckless way to go.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, A.L. Press.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with A.L. Press, an author and journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, and The Nation, among others. He was a 2011 Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation and the recipient of the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism. He's the author of Absolute Convictions, and his latest book just out is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the student loan racket. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Deanne Lunan, who is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the NCLC's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. Deanne is the author of the National Consumer Law Center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as numerous reports on the student loan industry and borrower issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deanne Lunan.
Thank you.
And there is a debt bomb ticking here in the United States from student loans. Student loan debt in the United States now totals more than $1 trillion, which is more than all of the outstanding credit card debt in the country. Do you see this as a sort of almost a replay of the subprime bubble that brought down Wall Street?
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of similarities, particularly in the private student loan market, which is actually only a part of the total student loan market. There are government loans and also private student loans. But there was a flourishing subprime market on the private loan side pretty much at the same time that it was all happening on the mortgage side and the credit card side. And people are paying the price now, or trying to pay the price, basically stuck in debt, just like they are on their homes and other credit.
So how did it get to the point, though, where the total student debt is $1 trillion, which is more than the outstanding credit card debt in the country?
Well, it's really a combination of factors that have been building over time. I mean, one thing is the cost of education, of higher education, has gone up exponentially over time. And I think anybody who's in college or has a child who's going to college or is pursuing higher education as an adult knows this. They know that college is expensive, and it's hard to figure out a way to pay for it. So at the same time that the cost has gone up, we've shifted as a policy matter from reliance more on grants, particularly for the lowest income students, to much more reliance on loans to pay for the education. So those two factors combined with the poor economy and other problems with people actually getting what they paid for out of school has led to this problem.
But what seems to be happening, though, here is so many of these graduates, and I'm not even talking about the for-profit schools, which is 90% taxpayer-funded, and I don't know whether you've noticed they're now advertising all over the place. So when people see advertising for these for-profit colleges, they ought to realize that that's their tax dollars being spent to advertise to get people in, and in many cases they end up with worthless diplomas and huge student debts, much greater debts, because all that's happening here is taxpayer money is going through these shingles, if you will, and then they mark them up. You know, it would be so much more humane if the government just lent directly to students, which they do in terms of Pell Grants and other things. But what really I find deeply upsetting is that we're making, or this system is making so many of our fellow citizens, young aspirants, a lot of minority kids and an awful lot of vets, making them economically non-functional for the rest of their adult lives.
Right, and I think there's two points that we have to realize as a policy matter. One is that we really started the higher education financial aid programs back in the 60s, sort of part of the Great Society. The goal was to increase equal access to education. In other words, to close the gap between the lowest income individuals in society and higher income individuals so that everyone basically who's qualified would have the opportunity to go to college. And interestingly, unfortunately, that gap has actually grown over time. So there's fewer lower income individuals who are completing college over time, and there's only it's only about 9% or so of lower income individuals who actually complete college. So the gap has grown, and I think that's one thing to look at is really a failure of policy. And at the same time, what we've done as a policy matter is we've made the consequences for people who don't succeed in school, who drop out, or who otherwise don't get what they paid for and aren't able to get a job to pay for the loans. We've made the consequences of that more and more draconian over time so that it's almost impossible to escape student loan debt, and the consequences where the government can crack down on you have grown over time as well.
What's happened is that college seniors who've graduated with student loans in 2010 owed an average of $25,250, which is up 5% from the previous year. But the parents have an average of $34,000 in student loans for their children. And a recent report from the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys said that the number of these parental loans has jumped 75% since 2006. So what you have here is a situation where it's both a problem for students and parents who have co-signed loans. And if the student defaults, the parent gets stuck with the bill and is hounded by the creditors. But then the student can't get a job because every time they check, every time a student with a defaulted loan goes for a job interview, they run a credit check, and he gets or he or she is punished because of their default.
Right. And I think one thing is that that's true, particularly for that's kind of the traditional student where they do have parents who are able to help. And unfortunately, a lot of those parents are suffering their own economic problems right now. So even if they, at the time when they co-signed the loan, thought that they would be in a pretty good financial position to pay it back, a lot of the parents aren't in as good of a situation as they thought. And it's not just, you know, sort of the traditional young people who go to college. The majority of students now actually who go to higher education are what they call non-traditional students, older working adults, and they don't often even have parents who were able to co-sign in the first place, and they're suffering the same consequences trying to figure out a way to get a job and pay off the loans. If they do have federal loans, one sort of bright spot, it's not perfect, but at least people should know that there are options to help manage the debt. Not eliminated except in really extreme circumstances, but at least manage the debt during hard times. The private loans are much harder. There's very little relief available for those.
Well, that's what happened in 2005, right, under President Bush's bankruptcy reform. One of the few achievements of the Bush administration, apart from the Iraq War and the vast run-up in the debt and the Afghan War and the crash of the economy.
Right. I mean, it was very, very almost hidden in the overall overhaul of the bankruptcy system that they made so many changes to it and made it so much harder for consumers to get relief through the bankruptcy system. They added a provision back in 2005 that made private student loans as difficult to discharge in bankruptcy as the government loans are. And the government loan bankruptcy provision actually hasn't been around forever either. It used to be easier for consumers to get relief from government loans in bankruptcy as well. But there's really no excuse, I mean, no reason to allow private lenders to have this, you know, additional help, really. It was a boon for the lenders that they can say to consumers who can't pay their private loans, well, you better come up with something because you're not going to be able to get relief in bankruptcy court.
So if you're a business that fails, you can file for bankruptcy. But if you're a college student or the parent of college students, you're hounded for life.
Yeah, and it's a pattern that's really just, there's no reason for it, and that's really why we fight so hard on behalf of student loan borrowers and the clients we work with. There's other things like the fact that for government student loans, the government can come after you forever. There's no statute of limitations, no time limit. And that's unprecedented. The only other areas where that really the government or can pursue you forever are for crimes like treason or murder. And so when in the policy debate we put student loan borrowers in that same grouping is really something that was a benefit for lenders and in some cases the schools, but it's certainly not something that is good for student borrowers.
Deanne, how did this for-profit college industry become such a hot business on Wall Street now? Wall Street's getting into the act. I understand that Kaplan, which is owned by the Washington Post, effectively subsidizes the Washington Post. There's clearly an enormous amount of money in this, in these private colleges, but President Obama tried to clean up the for-profit college industry because there was so much evidence that they were providing worthless diplomas and saddling kids with a lifetime of debt. And what happened to those reforms?
Yeah, well, it's a very sad story. And the for-profit industry, the school industry, has been around for a while. It's not new. And in fact, there was a crackdown back in the 90s. But what's new is the volume of schools and the amount of money that they're getting from the taxpayers and in the form of federal aid. And the reason that the schools have grown so much is because, as you mentioned, the Wall Street investment. That basically, most of the big companies are chains that are publicly traded companies, and Kaplan, for example, with the relation with the Washington Post and others. So the scope of the industry has grown over time. They're very, very aggressive in their recruiting so that in the military and other areas so that basically more and more federal dollars were funneled in that direction. So the Obama administration took a hard look at this and said, very understandably, if we're putting so much federal taxpayers into these schools, we want to see if the students are actually benefiting and how, what are the outcomes, what are the quality outcomes that are coming out of it. So the administration came up with a number of reforms through a regulatory process. A couple of those reforms did go through in a pretty strong way, including some challenges to the way that the schools do their recruiting. But the main reform, which was basically to have schools that are required to prepare students for gainful employment, have to show in some way that they really are preparing people for gainful employment. And that was the so-called gainful employment regulation. Started out as a pretty strong proposal that the Obama administration came up with, and there was so much lobbying and so much activity by the for-profit industry, advertising, all sorts of lobbyists they hired, that eventually the rule that came out of the process was watered down significantly.
Well, the person in charge that was Obama's friend at the White House, Cass Sunstein, and he appears to have rolled over for this onslaught of lobbying. Didn't the for-profit industry hire mostly Democratic lobbyists? You know, some of the big prominent Democrats in town, in Washington.
Yeah, they sure did, and not just Democrats from Clinton administration and others, but also, you know, those who used to work actually at the Department of Education itself. So they had sort of a whole team of people that really put on the hard press, and unfortunately, it worked. And part of it, interestingly, was demonizing the short sellers on Wall Street, people like Steve Eisman and others who were warning of this problem, and they actually sort of demonized them as part of the process, sort of changed the subject in a lot of ways, because regardless of the source of the information, what some of the Wall Street short sellers were putting forth was actually accurate information showing how poorly these schools were performing.
So how is it then that we had one of the Republican presidential candidates who dropped out because he couldn't even remember his own policies? He was jokingly referred to as the candidate for those Republicans who thought George W. Bush was too cerebral. I refer to Governor Perry, who, when asked what government departments he wanted to ban, he remembered the Commerce Department and the Education Department, but couldn't remember the third one. Now, what is it about these Republicans who want to get rid of the Department of Education, whereas somebody like John Boehner, who's a huge champion for these for-profit colleges, isn't that where all the money comes from? I mean, I'd like to know, and I don't know whether you have the figures, Deanne Lunan, what percentage of the budget of the Department of Education goes into this for-profit college racket? That's my word, racket, not yours. You don't have to agree with me.
Yeah, no, I don't know the exact figures of aid. It's somewhere around 8 or 9% of all students actually attend these schools, but somewhere in the vicinity of 20% or maybe more than that of the aid goes to the schools, and that sort of, those numbers have changed over time. So that's the way we can really measure is the federal aid dollars, and that's just from the Department of Education. That doesn't count, for example, the aid that goes to these schools to the Department of Defense as part of the new GI Bill, and there was a new study that Senator Harkin just announced today where they looked at how much of the Department of Defense aid is actually going to the for-profit schools. So there's a lot of federal money going to these schools, and that's why their lobbying is so strong. They want to keep that money coming. And frankly, the for-profit industry gives money to policymakers on both sides of the aisle. It's not just the Republicans. And so why they would want to abolish the Department of Education, or at least some of them would, I'm not sure. But I think those who particularly are working or getting a lot of funds from the for-profit industry probably really, really don't want the Department of Education to disappear.
So is it about $40 billion a year that taxpayer subsidies going to for-profit, or is it more than that?
Do you have a figure?
I don't know the exact figure because you also want to count in, as I said,
the Department of Defense,
all the different agencies, and then there's also state money going to the schools as well.
So you're, Deanne Noonan, again, attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the National Consumer Law Center Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. What can be done to the for these students that are, as I mentioned, get saddled with debt where U.S. taxpayer funds are then marked up heavily by these for-profit colleges? And whether or not the diploma is any good, the statistics are fairly clear that the graduates of these schools have a hard time getting jobs, and they've got all this huge debt. Give us a sense of the of where the relief is. You said there's some bright spots here.
Yeah, and there is, and we work with some borrowers, some low-income borrowers directly, although it's a limited number, and we have a website with more information. If you have a federal student loan, a government loan, there are actually quite a few options. As I mentioned, there's the possibility of canceling the loan, although those really apply in very limited circumstances. But if you went to a school that closed, for example, while you were there, you can get the loan eliminated, and there are some other limited ways that you can do that. If you can't cancel the loan, and this is what applies to most borrowers, whether you're in default or not, there are ways to get out of default, if you are in default, and get into an affordable repayment plan. And this is basically the income-based repayment plan that the Congress passed in just a couple of years ago. In some cases, a lot of my clients, for example, have payments that are zero under the income-based repayment plan. Obviously, they're not paying their loans off when you have a zero payment, but at least they're current. They don't have to worry about the government coming after them. They can go back to school if that's what they're hoping to do and get new loans and grants. And the government will actually forgive the balance, but not until after you've paid for 25 years, if there is a still balance after that, and that's actually going to go down to 20 years. So basically with the government loans, there are those kinds of options. Some are better than others, but at least there are ways manage the debt. On the private loan side, unfortunately, you're basically at the mercy of your lender. There's no comprehensive law like there is for federal government loans that says to the lenders, you must provide flexible payment or deferments or cancellations. Some private lenders will do that, but it's generally sort of a case-by-case negotiation process.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Deanne Noonan. And for the work that you do.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Deanne Noonan, who's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the National Consumer Law Center's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. Deanne is the author of the National Consumer Law Center's publications, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as numerous reports on the student loan industry and borrower issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.